Hello, my friends. It's May 2nd, 2022. My name is Chris, and you are tuned in to Canadian Patriot Radio. We got a very good confirmation of something we covered in the last show last week when we were picking apart the mainstream media's coverage of a so-called study saying that the unvaccinated are a risk to the vaccinated when mixing. We've got news to cover about Pierre Poilievre wanting to ban digital currencies in Canada. We got the world's top Nazi hunter condemning Trudeau for his role in Ukraine. And we are going to listen to a couple of clips. One big one from O'Bannon's War Room. He had on a guest that really covered the data that's going into the new documentary, 2000 Mules. We're going to listen to her tell us exactly what the proof or the evidence is that they have, which is irrefutable. You can't spin it. You can't do anything with it. And then we're also going to listen to even more information coming out about the Pfizer vaccines. But first, I want to head back to this Western Standard article that kind of ties into the last show that we had. And the title of this one reads, "Critics say widely shared study on mixing with unvaccinated contains massive errors." This is written by Matthew Horwood, and it was published 4 days ago on April 28th, 2022. A viral immunologist says David Fishman's study is the worst one I have ever seen and that the paper is thinly veiled hate speech under the guise of science. A data scientist and viral immunologist are questioning the results of a recent study that found that mixing with the unvaccinated increases COVID-19 risk for vaccinated people. As a researcher who has published and reviewed many scientific papers, I can tell you the article by David Fishman, ETAL, is the worst one I have ever seen, said Byram W. Bridle, a viral immunologist and former professor at University of Guelph. Joseph Hickey, executive director at the Ontario Civil Liberties Association, said the paper's authors are either incompetent or disingenuous, and that the media's disproportionate coverage of the study risks causing societal vilification of people who have refused medical intervention aggressively promoted by governments and large corporations. The research published Monday in the Canadian Medical Association Journal found vaccinated people who mix with the unvaccinated have a greater chance of being infected than those who spend time with people who have received the shot. The study was covered by virtually every mainstream media outlet in Canada on Monday. David Fishman, study co-author and professor at the University of Toronto's Dalhousie Lana School of Public Health, acknowledged that the paper's simple mathematical model does not fully reflect the real world or the diverse factors that must be taken into account when setting public health policy. Bridle called the paper thinly veiled hate speech under the guise of science and said it is littered with massive errors. These include incorrectly assuming the vaccines offer full sterilizing immunity, not modeling the real-world phenomenon of waning immunity from vaccines, assuming without evidence that booster shots provide restored protection against the Omicron variant, and not mentioning the safety issues around COVID-19 vaccines. Bridle also noted the paper's assumption baseline immunity among the unvaccinated is only 20%, whereas other peer-reviewed studies showed that that number was closer to 90%. Bridle claimed, by adjusting the single parameter to better reflect real-world data, virus transmission in the model then occurs disproportionately from vaccinated people, thus completely reversing the conclusions of the paper. The peer reviewers of this article should be ashamed of themselves for not allowing this to be published. And the editors even more so, Bridle said. I honestly believe the authors need to be investigated, as does the editor who allowed the paper to be published. When Hickey examined the article, he found its main conclusion that risks of infection among vaccinated people can be disproportionately attributed to unvaccinated people to be incorrect according to the model. Hickey said Fishman and his colleagues concocted a new parameter never before defined in the scientific literature, which they called the unvaccinated contribution of to infection risk. He said they incorrectly characterized their own parameter and used it as the only basis for their main conclusion. The parameter was said to mean a normalized index of the degree to which risk in one group may be disproportionately driven by contact with another. But Hickey pointed out the model is blind as to whether the contacts in the normalizing denominator are infectious or benign, irrespective of vaccination status. Hickey said the journalists who reported on the study, and the vast majority of whom who didn't understand the data analysis, should have recognized their limits and sought expert counter-opinions before participating in their mobbing of unvaccinated people. Hickey also pointed out that Fishman has served on advisory boards related to influenza and COVID-19 vaccines for Pfizer, AstraZeneca, Seqirus, and Sanofi Pasteur vaccines. Well, well, well. Isn't it neat what happens in a week's time with a so-called study and with the counter narrative or qualified people looking into this study? Isn't it neat how the narrative has changed? Now, in the last show, you know, we pointed out the fact that we didn't think that they were accounting for natural immunity at all. And Byron Bridal picked up right where we left off, pointing out that what he had mentioned, that they went under the assumption that natural immunity was 20%. Well, lo and behold, there are studies already in Canada that are showing that it's about 90% among unvaccinated people. And it's the same, the numbers are the same in the UK. So you've got a correlation between countries when it comes to actual natural immunity among unvaccinated people. So it's safe to say that this was just a 100%, exactly what we said in the last episode, this was 100% a divisional tactic. They were literally trying to do the same playbook again to get to get vaccinated people to turn on unvaccinated people. But it didn't work this time. It fell flat on its face, didn't it, my friends? Why would that be? Well, it's because vaccinated people keep getting COVID. And that's why they're also not getting their booster. Like we discussed, I know I did a little bit of digging into what the actual numbers were for the booster in Canada. And overall, it's low. But in specific age groups, it's actually quite high. When you get to the older generations, they're actually up around 70%. But it's my generations and younger that aren't buying into the third shot, and some of the older ones too. But you still have a big portion of the boomer generation, let's just put it that way, that have already gone out and got their third shot. Whereas the younger generations, us Gen Xers and the millennials, Gen Z, and so on. They aren't getting their boosters. It's as low as 40% in these generations. So that's what we need to keep seeing, my friends. We need to see people just saying enough already. And not to mention, just to prove that I'm not anti-vax at all, I've got every vaccine under the sun except for this one and the flu vaccine. I've never bought into that one either, because I mean, with a virus that can mutate as quickly as 14 days, what's the point? You know, they take the most dominant strand of the flu and they build their vaccine a year later on the dominant strand from the year before, when it has the potential to have mutated how many times in a year since then. It's a pointless vaccine. So that's why I never got the flu shot, just simply because I looked into how quickly the flu virus can actually mutate. But what I'm getting at here is there are now actual alternatives that are showing some merit to the mRNA shots. So, you know, you've got Novavax, which is now approved in Canada, and you've also got the Medicago vaccine, which is, I've looked into it quite heavily. I've been watching that one quite close. They're partnered with GlaxoSmithKline, and they have an adjuvant that's made from basically the bark of a tree that actually helps the... they basically have a spike protein, just a portion of the spike protein that they inject into your body, and it acts as an actual vaccine. Your body finds it, kills it, and then has the defense for it. So these actually truly are vaccines, not this mRNA garbage that have been pushed down our throats for the last 2 years. So what I'm getting at is, for people that are kind of like me, you're not actually an anti-vaxxer. You're more of a I need to see proof and data that these vaccines are safe and effective, and I want them to be around for a while. It's looking like there is actual alternatives that are showing some merit. Now, I'm not saying go out and get the shots. I mean, basically, us people on our side have been kind of fighting shots and learning lots about vaccines. It turns out there's a lot of troubles with vaccines, you know, with aborted fetal tissue and all sorts of things and you know, high aluminum and all sorts of stuff that shouldn't be in vaccines that are in vaccines that can cause damage to you. But what I'm getting at is the fact that there are companies that don't seem to be malevolent in nature, creating vaccines that are now on the market. So if you are older and you've made it this far without getting a shot and you are still worried about the risks associated with COVID-19, it's looking like there are safe alternatives for a shot if you want to go that way. So that's just to prove to people that, you know, even though we speak out against the mRNA shots that are experimental and still haven't received full approval, and I doubt they really actually will, we're going to cover a clip that's actually going to talk about that today. But so either take it or leave it. I mean, it's up to you, just like it should be, right? I would never push any shots on anybody. And that's the way our government and our medical healthcare center, our medical profession in Canada used to be and still should be. Anyway, my friends, let's get this show started. We'll be right back. Welcome, friends, to Canadian Patriot Radio, where conspiracy is not theory and political corruption finds the spotlight. CPR, we are committed to upholding Canadians' God-given rights to life, liberty, and freedom with all thy sons. Command. All right, welcome back, my friends. Now we've got the Rolling Thunder Convoy in Ottawa, which is our Canadian bikers, all supporting basically veterans and people's rights to choose. From what I understand, it's going quite well. There's been a few arrests, just minor stuff. They've not permitted one or two people from not attending, just from previous charges and so on and so forth. From what I understand, it's going well. Thus far, what I wanted to do was just circle back to the Trudeau government. They were relying on fake news to pass their Emergencies Act, and this next quick little clip comes to us by True North, by Candace Malcolm, and it was written on April 29th, 2022, and the title reads, "The Trudeau government relied on CBC's fake news to freeze Canadians' bank accounts." Despite the fact that the CBC publicly retracted a news story about the Freedom Convoy that erroneously claimed that support for the protest had largely come from foreigners, the Trudeau government relied on the state broadcaster to justify its use of the Emergencies Act. This week, Attorney General David Lamenti confirmed that the government relied on false CBC reports when freezing the bank accounts of Canadians who supported the protest. Plus, weeks after the legacy media freaked out about a conservative MP calling Justin Trudeau a dictator, so-called journalists go silent after a Liberal MP accuses Doug Ford of crimes against humanity. So, just a quick little clip there from Candace Malcolm. Now we know that the Trudeau government is loopholing their own state media. They're running stories to justify movement on specific, basically, laws to, I guess, open the wings of fascism on the Canadian people. Now, where have we seen this before? Where fake news is used to justify fascist behavior from a government. We've seen it in the U.S. January 6th comes to mind. You know, the Canadian government tried to follow the January 6th model to a T. They started calling it an occupation. They were using all this rhetoric that was complete BS. So we've already seen the playbook. These people are so stupid, they can't even sway off their own playbook, even after they've shown it to us. And it's just the same thing over and over and over. You'll always see it. Like, they just can't come up with anything new. It's really kind of gross to watch, really, the fact that they can't come up with any new material. But just an interesting little tidbit that I wanted to cover and share with you guys. Now, staying on the topic of Trudeau and everything that he's doing wrong within Canada and abroad, this next article comes to us by way of Newspunch. And the title reads, World's Top Nazi Hunter Condemns Trudeau for Sending 794 Million Training Neo-Nazis in Ukraine. This is by Baxter Dimitri, and it was written on April 14th, 2022. The world's most prominent Nazi hunter has condemned Justin Trudeau and the Canadian government supporting Nazism and training neo-Nazi fighters in Ukraine, declaring that the governments and medias across the West are misleading the public when they claim Ukraine is not overrun by Nazis. Ephraim Zurov, the director of the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Israel, believes it is a lack of due diligence on the part of the Trudeau and the Canadian government rather than a conscious policy decision to support Nazis in Europe. The Canadian government didn't do its due diligence, Zurov told the Ottawa Citizen on Wednesday. It's the responsibility of the Canadian Defense Ministry to know exactly who they are training. There is no question that there are neo-Nazis in different forms in Ukraine, whether they are in the Azov Regiment or other organizations, he added. Zurov's comments came after a Radio Canada report on Monday that back in November 2020, Canadian troops were photographed training members of the Azov Regiment, including soldiers bearing the insignia of the SS Division Galician, a Ukrainian unit that fought with Hitler's Nazis in World War II. The authenticity of the photo was acknowledged by the Canadian military, so the Ottawa Citizen reported. But Canadian forces CAF rejected the idea they have any obligation to ensure the foreign troops they are training are not Nazis or terrorists. Captain Veronica Saborin told the Ottawa Citizen that it is Ukraine's responsibility to vet its own personnel. All Canadian military members training Ukrainian troops were briefed on how to recognize insignia associated with right-wing extremism. Oh, here we go. Labeling, they're trying to always create that tie between Nazism and right-wing extremism, and I'm sorry, but it falls flat. And I'll tell you why. Because in Mein Kampf, Hitler's own book, he repeatedly describes himself as a socialist liberal. He was left-wing. He was a left-wing politician. But they always try to create this gap. They try to blame the right for what they themselves are doing. But don't even fall for that. There's, you know, it just falls back into that left-right paradigm, the fake left-right thing that we've got going on, when they're just branches of the same tree. You know, that's whatever, right? Let's carry on. And if they suspected such ties or racist views, the trainees would be removed. However, there is no burden of proof on the CAF to demonstrate this beyond a reasonable doubt. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's regime has vocally supported Ukraine since February 24th, when Russia sent troops into the neighboring country on a mission to demilitarize and denazify the government in Kiev. Governments and media across the West have since begun to insist the claims about Azov and other units of the Ukrainian military having Nazi sympathies was Russian disinformation. It's not Russian propaganda, far from it, Zurov told The Citizen. These people are neo-Nazis. There is an element of the ultra-right in Ukraine, and it's absurd to ignore it. Even he's got it wrong. Maybe they are. Maybe some people identify as ultra-right, and maybe there is Nazism on that side. But I personally, when you actually study history, real history, it has closer ties to the left. That just bothers me that they've made that reach to blame it all on the right. As you can tell. Canada has spent nearly $1 billion, US $794 million, on training Ukrainian troops since the 2014 coup in which Western-backed rebels overthrew the country's democratically elected government. Neo-Nazi fighters were instrumental in the regime change operation, and fascists in the Azov Battalion were used to suppress dissent afterwards. According to The Citizen, Canada's Joint Task Force Ukraine actually produced a briefing in 2017 admitting that they had been training Nazis, writing multiple members of the Azov have described themselves as Nazis. So it comes from themselves. It comes internally. No surprise. I'm sure some of you have seen a report now that there's been over 3,000 Ukrainian citizens killed. They're blaming it on the Russians. I personally believe that it's probably Ukrainians themselves are the bulk majority. I know there's going to be collateral damage with the Russian advancement in Ukraine. I'm not blind to that. I totally understand that, and I'm fully aware that there will be civilian casualties as a result of Russia being in Ukraine. But I think at this point, Western media is so full of lies, so chock full of lies and propaganda, you literally can't believe anything that they are telling you. And it's actually safe to assume that probably the bulk majority of casualties were by other Ukrainians, possibly neo-Nazis, committing crimes against their own people in their own country, like we've seen before in Ukraine. We've already seen it before. I find the Russians have been very tactical so far in their advancement throughout Ukraine. And of course, like, it's not a flawless military campaign that they're running in Ukraine, but they are doing quite well, if you really want my opinion. And they themselves are in, if you want my opinion, are actually being more humanitarian than the actual Ukrainians. But of course, over here we're getting, you know, Ukraine is just a cesspool of corruption, and everybody in Western government is getting a piece of that pie. So they're going to defend it come hell or high water, because they cannot afford to allow the information to get out of Ukraine that each of them have been involved in. Probably in Canada as well as the U.S. We know the Bidens are neck deep. We know Pelosi's neck deep. We know all of them. All your major left-wing figures in the U.S. are neck deep in Ukraine. So they're going to do everything they possibly can to hide everything that was going on in Ukraine, which probably involves child trafficking, drug and arms deals. Like, from what I'm understanding, the weapons that are being supplied to Ukraine from the U.S. and Canada are now being turned around and sold on the black market. Like, so this is just a money funneling operation. Like, it's not even being used within the Ukrainian regiments. They're just turning around and selling it. So the Canadian government is involved in the arms trading arms deals now, if you really want to get technical to what's actually going on there. Allegedly. I have to throw that in there to protect myself, but there are a lot of reports coming out of there now that are saying that, you know, all these weapons are being sold on the black market, and they're ending up in the hands of our enemies. Big surprise. Like, in Canada, we welcome our enemies with open arms. We legitimately, you guys have heard me say this before, we haven't had an actual real government in this country since December 4th, 2017, when the Liberals decided to vote. They voted to allow enemies of Canada into this country. That's aiding and abetting enemies of this country, which can be classified as high treason, which is still punishable by death in Canada. They only kept Trudeau, Freeland, and just the internal members of the upper echelons of the Liberal Party out of that vote. Very wisely. That was one wise move on their part. But the rest of them, including Raybould, voted to have enemies of Canada be integrated within our society. Anyway, my friends, let's move on. Okay, let's swing over to Polivier. Now, I mentioned earlier in the show, like, don't fall for the left-right paradigm, and I've said this in previous shows before. Like, I do like the People's Party of Canada, but I'm really starting to think that I don't think we can split this vote. Now, is Pierre Poilievre a World Economic Forum puppet? Very possible. It's very possible that he could be. He's listed on their page. I don't know if he's been to Davos. I don't know, but he is speaking perfect. Basically conservative speech. Now that's always a little bit unnerving. And what have the conservatives done in the past? They will do things in the public sphere that looks like they are appeasing the Canadian people's wishes while backdoor dealing against the Canadian people. Case in point would be Stephen Harper going to the G6 summit and calling out Vladimir Putin in the public sphere, saying that, you know, he was a dictator and blah 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 blah. Meanwhile, in backdoor deals, he was unsecuring all of our accounts. This is the way that the conservatives operate. They do things right out of the limelight, which to me actually tells me that I would say that the right wing branch of the same tree is actually in more control, because they do things even more clandestine or inconspicuous. Whereas the liberals seem to just do it out in the open. They don't care. So what I'm getting at is, I think that if you really want my opinion of which branch of the tree holds more power, when the conservatives are sneaky and hiding the fact that they are still going against the Canadian people, and then forcing the left wing or the fascists that masquerade as liberals to be out in the open, I think they're setting it up so that people come back to the right side of the tree, right? All that being said, I still think I've got to go with Poilievre, because we cannot allow the fascists masquerading as liberals to completely bury this country, which by 2025, when this election is going to come around, Canada could be no more. It's a very real possibility. But Poilievre is saying the right things right now, so we're going to cover it. Now, this one comes to us by way of the National Telegraph, and the title reads, Pierre Poilievre commits to banning central bank digital currency CBDC in Canada. This was written by Wyatt Claypool, and it doesn't give me a date for some reason. The National Telegraph over the last few weeks has been pushing hard on the issue of the central bank digital currency in Canada and asking various Conservative Party leadership campaigns about their position on the issue. We had spoken to Carleton MP Pierre Poilievre and his campaign team several times about the issue, and did get confirmation from Poilievre himself that he was going against CBDCs and thinking of ways to best place a ban on them at a campaign stop in Calgary. Now, in further development on Poilievre's position on CBDCs, this morning he publicly stated in a press release and on social media posts that he will be seeking to both audit the printing of currency by the Bank of Canada, as well as outright ban the central bank implementing a digital currency. In his campaign press release, Poilievre was quoted saying, "Money printing deficits have sent more dollars bidding up the price of goods. Inflationary taxes have made it more expensive for businesses to produce these goods. The more liberals spend, the more things cost. That's just inflation. I will end it by restoring central bank independence, mandating an independent audit of all the money printing, and stopping the risky central bank digital currency." His campaign further stated that a Pierre Poilievre government will keep the Bank of Canada out of retail banking by banning its proposed central bank digital currency. The Bank of Canada indicates it is in the development phase of its own digital currency, and that the final decision will rest with the Minister of Finance. It is a major step forward to have the front-running Conservative Party leadership candidate not only telling individual journalists that he is against digital currencies, but publicly calling for them to be banned. Central bank digital currency in Canada should be a no-brainer of an issue for Conservatives to run against, as it will be hard for Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to justify why the government needs the ability to track and control the way Canadians spend their money. Pierre Poilievre coming out strongly against digital currencies should signal to other Conservatives that this is a major issue they also need to sound off on. In the coming weeks, hopefully more conservative leadership candidates will come out and unify against digital currencies and help unify the party in Parliament against the Liberal central bank power grab. So a very good short article about what kind of, you know, what we want to hear. Where Poilievre stands on a few other issues, that's yet to be seen. But he's definitely on the right track when it comes to this one. So this is, if you want my opinion, digital currencies are the biggest threat to freedom in Canada, the U.S., Europe. This is the one thing that people have to unite against above all else. this will significantly end freedom as we know it. This level of control. Now they've already got a problem. They've already got digital currencies that are decentralized with Bitcoin and Ethereum and all the others that are already out there, and that's going to be an issue for them. But like we've talked in the past, how free are they really, and how much access could governments gain to them if they actually got their own digital currencies through? I think your only safe bet is tangible precious metals. Or commodities, for that matter. Like, get your hands on some, basic, right now, I would say flour. You should be buying up flour like crazy. You could use it to trade. If there's the shortages that are predicted to happen, that in itself, every commodity, whether it be flour, sugar, salt, for fuck's sakes, could end up being a commodity. Salt, butter, you know, if they force this digital currency, you guys have heard me say this lots, a trade and barter system would be the alternative for those of us until we could get something set up independently away from the government. But they're overplaying their hand here. I just don't think they're going to get it. You've got the same pushback in the U.S. With these. Actually, the pushback is coming from the Fed, the Federal Reserve, to their digital currencies, to Biden and his digital currency push in the U.S. Well, that's a major problem for the U.S. Now, if they cannot get a digital currency in the U.S., the whole thing falls apart. For us in North America, we got to watch our American cousins quite closely, because if the Fed is actually fighting digital currencies in the U.S., not necessarily fighting it, but they're dragging their feet on it, and there are people that just seem to not align with the Biden regime in the Fed. So I think you've got, I guess the best way to put it is you've got patriots right now in the Fed, the Federal Reserve in the U.S., and if they can't get the Fed to roll into a digital currency, the whole thing is stagnant. It's not going to happen. And they'll actually effectively, in a way, save the dollar globally by doing it. Now, if you could get the Fed to do what Russia did and back their currency but with gold, it stops its dead in its tracks. Now, right now, the Democrats, or let's just call them what they are, the fascists that masquerade as liberals in the U.S. as well, with them having the House, the Senate, and the presidency, it's actually quite amazing that they haven't been able to get anything through that they should have. They really have been kind of stagnant. And the reasons being is you've got opposition in other branches of government. And in regards to the Fed, you've got opposition, or at least people that are slowing down the process of the digital currency push that way. Very interesting, to say the least. All right, my friends, what I want to do, we've got a couple clips that probably will take us a little bit over the hour, but that's fine. What I want to do first is I want to turn your attention to a show called Redacted with Clayton Morris. They're going through the latest in the Pfizer revelations, and they did a really good job with this one. So let's turn it over to Redacted. And we'll chat about this after.
Well, the last time that we covered this story, the Pfizer story on this show, YouTube blocked us and told us that it was medical misinformation. Those were their words. The data that we were reporting on came directly from Pfizer's very own documents released for everyone to read. You could go and read them, including your family. Your little kids could read them if they wanted to. It would put them right to sleep. They were published, in fact, on the CDC's very own website. Thanks to a court order and because of the Freedom of Information Act request, we are now receiving regular document dumps from Pfizer. We should look forward to this, right? Because now we're getting some pretty detailed and startling information. In fact, 1 week from now, the third Pfizer data drop will occur. In March, we had 10,000 pages released. In April, we had 11,000 pages released. And guess what, guys? The big one coming up, 80,000 pages. So get out your favorite cocktail, get out your reading glasses. It's going to be a big one. But guess what? Before the next big document dump happens, We just received something huge in the past few days, perhaps even more important than all of the documents they've released so far. You see, Pfizer just released their annual report to the Securities and Exchange Commission. I'm going to pull this up here. This is the SEC filing from the Securities and Exchange Commission. You see, Pfizer just released their annual report to the SEC on the efficacy of its current mRNA vaccines and its ability to make money off of COVID. They have to basically tell shareholders, like, hey, we're either going to be profitable or we're not. So you need to make a decision whether or not to invest or not invest in us, this company. Okay. But I want to draw your attention to scrolling down to page 6 of this document. It's not too far down. It's not buried terribly deep. But if you do scroll down to page 6 and 7, you'll notice a section called risk factors. And at the top of the risk factors section has this quote, quote, our revenue depends heavily on the sales of our COVID vaccines, right? And our future revenues from our COVID-19 vaccines are uncertain. Then we skip down to the third paragraph, okay? If we just go down to the third paragraph here, and I'll leave it up to you to decide which of these paragraphs is more troubling. We may not be able to demonstrate sufficient efficacy, I'm quoting now, we may not be able to demonstrate the sufficient efficacy or safety of our COVID-19 vaccine and or our variant-specific formulations to obtain regulatory approval in the United States, the United Kingdom, the European Union, and other countries where it has been authorized for emergency use or granted conditional marketing approval. Let that soak in for just a second, okay? Just let that sink in. Let that flow over you. Pfizer is admitting in their own documents to the SEC that due to safety concerns and the efficacy sufficiency of their vaccines, they are not likely to gain regulatory approval for their vaccines.
Okay.
So in essence, continuing, please to use, just go on. Don't actually approve us. Just use the emergency authorization protocol, which of course you've been using throughout all of the pandemic, which does not rise to the level of scrutiny required for regulatory approval. So what could these concerns be? Could it have anything to do with the data that we covered here a few weeks ago, which got us banned on YouTube and blocked? Not on Rumble, though. We're still cranking nicely on Rumble, so thank you to those.
We're always ready to rumble.
We're always ready to rumble. Could it be that data? Pfizer's very own data that was released and available on the CDC's website? The things that are blocked on YouTube and you're not allowed to share them? Could it be the deaths associated with said vaccine? Probably not. I'm just being cynical, right? It probably has nothing to do with the efficacy there at all. Actually, Pfizer, once again, in these documents to the SEC, talks about the adverse effects of this of their vaccines. If we scroll down to the page below, they talk about the adverse effects. Significant adverse events may occur during our clinical trials or even after receiving regulatory approval, which could delay or terminate clinical trials, delay or prevent regulatory approval or market acceptance of any of our product candidates, end quote. So in essence, these few paragraphs, Pfizer is admitting to basically that the emperor has no clothes in all of this. And what's remarkable is that all of these major pharmaceutical companies are shielded by the governments that deployed these emergency vaccines. You see, in order for these governments around the world to use these medicines, they had to agree to indemnify the companies against legal prosecution. The United States government, European countries, Canada, and others went along with it. Do you know why these vaccines are not available in India? Because the Indian government said, no, you're not going to be protected and shielded from prosecution if something goes wrong. So guess what? They're not available in India.
Is that true?
That's true. Yesterday in Canada, the president of AstraZeneca was pressed on exactly this question about indemnification. Watch this remarkable moment unfold in Canada, the president of AstraZeneca in Canada.
This question is for both witnesses. We'll start with Ms. Coombs. A previous witness has told us that the global distribution of vaccine is subject to indemnification clauses that countries have to sign on to, meaning that if something goes wrong, your companies are shielded from liability. People cannot sue if they experience or perceive they have experienced vaccine injuries. Instead, any compensation would be paid out by a no-fault mechanism funded by COVAX, to which industry does not contribute. This witness further told us that you had asked for this protection as part of your agreements. So could you please explain why your company asked for indemnification clauses, why public bodies should assume those liabilities, and whether these indemnification clauses would apply in cases where information had been withheld by your company with respect to risks?
So I'm not privileged as to specifically the indemnification clause in the contract that you speak of. What I can say is that AstraZeneca stands behind our medicines and the safety profile of our medicines. And so,
ma'am, sorry to jump in, but you're the Canadian president of the company here, and you're telling me you're not aware of the details of the indemnification clauses. We're told that you asked for them. So why did you ask for them?
I asked for the indemnification clause on the VEX, Sevria contract with Canada. So I'm clear.
We were told by a previous witness who's affiliated with Gavi that industry representatives asked for indemnification clauses as part of contracts for the global distribution of vaccines. Why?
I think that indemnification clauses in all of my time in the pharmaceutical industry is standard part of contracting. The specific details in which you talk about, I just am not at I don't have knowledge to answer.
Enough at all, but I wonder if Mr. Paquette can come in on that.
Yeah, so you're the president of the company. Why would you know anything about these indemnification clauses in there? And to his point about asking the question as to, well, if your company withheld information about the efficacy and safety of these vaccines, how can you still then be indemnified? Don't ask these questions. So no matter the adverse effects, it wouldn't matter because you can't sue them anyway. But here's the amazing part of the story, if that wasn't already enough. Investors who buy stock in these companies could sue them if they didn't disclose this information in their filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Isn't that funny? That's why we're learning about this.
Wait. Investors can sue.
Oh, yeah. So you can actually, investors, if they didn't disclose this in their SEC filings,
right?
Why they're not profitable or the problems with their vaccine, therefore
yes,
leading to lower revenue,
yes,
as an investor, you could sue them as an investor. But if you have adverse effects because of their vaccine.
But you as a person whose body reacted badly could not,
You could not because the indemnification clauses that they signed with these governments. But good thing that Wall Street is protected and investors are protected. Again, let that sink in for a moment. Big Pharma hides this information from the American people and the rest of the world, but they openly release this information to investors. Now, beyond the adverse effects and all of the problems associated with these drugs, I want to go ahead to page 7, which has perhaps the most startling paragraph of all. And I'm going to pull it up here. This is page 7 of the Pfizer SEC filings. And it says this: even if we obtain full regulatory approval for our COVID-19 vaccine and product candidates, the products may not gain the market acceptance among physicians, doctors, patients, and hospitals, cancer treatment centers, and others in the medical community necessary for commercial success.
I don't understand.
I'll explain it. So what if those pesky doctors get in the way, right? So what they're saying is, even if we do get regulatory approval, well, we might have problems because they might not gain the market acceptance among doctors, patients, hospitals, or cancer treatment centers in the medical community.
But this document was only just published for the SEC, and Pfizer has had widespread approval from doctors. So they're saying if they continue through their full trials, that doctors won't like the data they see.
Yes. Well, if they actually had access to the data. The point is, of course, that many doctors have been silenced, right? Many doctors who have spoken out against the efficacy have lost their jobs. We've reported those stories here on this show. So what if those pesky doctors get in the way? You know, those people that spend 13 years in advanced education studying how the human body reacts to pathogens and medicines?
Or if they actually get the data that they've need to make a fair assessment, which they have not.
Right. Well, if they had access to that data, how can we get rid of these people? How can we get these people out of the way and so that we can have commercial success? Where can we find politicians who would be willing to do our bidding? Where could we find politicians willing to kneecap doctors? Ah, California.
Of course, it's California.
California. California Democrats are looking to do just that. Here's the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Well, California Democrats are looking to do just that. And I know this sounds like it's fake or made up news, but no. This is the Wall Street Journal, and this is a real bill. Headline, California's medical misinformation crusade could cost lives as with COVID treatment. Democratic lawmakers in California have proposed a new bill, a new piece of legislation that would require the state medical board to take action against doctors found to be spreading misinformation related to the nature and the risks of the virus, its prevention and treatment, and the development and safety and effectiveness of COVID-19 vaccines. So, put another way, doctors in California who notice problems or adverse effects could lose their medical licenses for speaking up about these vaccines.
They'll be essentially deplatformed.
Yes, and they have been.
Right.
And we already have doctors who have lost their jobs and were told to go pound sand because of their stance on this. So they're deplatformed. They're deplatformed from their hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But I just want to read a section of this bill. I'm going to put this up here on the screen. It's three paragraphs, but I think it's really important for us to read. This is from the Wall Street Journal about this bill in California. And I want to read a section about what this anti-doctor bill would do, according to the Wall Street Journal. Quote, the legislation would require the state medical board to take action against doctors found to be spreading, quote, misinformation related to the nature and risks of the virus, its prevention and treatment, and the development, safety, and effectiveness of COVID-19 vaccines. So what is this misinformation? It's not clearly defined, but the bill would instruct the board to consider whether a doctor's order or opinion deviates from the standard of care, i.e. recommendations by the government or treatments that are widely used by healthcare practitioners, and is contradicted by contemporary scientific consensus. Third paragraph. So doctors who prescribe or recommend treatments that haven't been approved by the Food and Drug Administration for COVID-19, for example, the antidepressant fluvoxamine, which has been shown strong results in trials, could be disciplined and even lose their medical licenses, no matter if they have scientific evidence to support them. Same for doctors who disagree with masking and, of course, vaccines for children. So these documents that Pfizer tried to keep hidden are showing troubling data. They're admitting that sales are down and their medicine is probably not good enough to pass regulatory muster. And even if it does get approved, they might receive big pushback from the medical community. And California is working to pass a bill that would punish doctors for using science and their expertise. That, my friends, is incredibly troubling. And this is, again, the data continues to come out quietly, hidden in these documents. And thank God, I mean, we actually have investors who invest in these companies. We can actually get honest information from Wall Street SEC filings, but we have to wait for these 80,000 pages to get even like little nuggets of information.
Yes.
From the court filings.
You know, it's interesting in the chat, Lisa Pettit, I think, asked, what are we considered efficacy, right? And originally we thought it meant it would stop the spread of COVID. That's no longer the common refrain is that we take the vaccine in order to mitigate the reaction in your own body to the virus, right? To keep you out of the hospital. But recent videos by Dr. John Campbell on this very platform, YouTube, have shown that the antibodies from the vaccine dip after a certain number of weeks, leaving you completely unprotected after a certain amount of time, no matter how many boosters you have. But naturally being infected with the vaccine, with COVID, which I think they're saying now 70 to 80% of the UK has, is leading to a natural level of immunity that we don't need to continue to depend on these. But it does show that immunity does dip after a certain exposure. So that's what we're considering efficacy. So he's comfortable saying efficacy dips, right? Although you are protected in the first couple of weeks, months. I mean, it really varies. After the vaccine. And so what they're saying here is very leading when they use the word efficacy, because they say we're not sure about it. So that's interesting.
I've also had interesting friends who are traders and said they've like taken bets right now on Pfizer's stock price. And one of them said they bet another one of their traders that by the end of the year, by the end of 2022, They will, in fact, see a halving of their price. Their stock will be cut in half in value. And I have to, you know, wonder if that's going to happen because there's a number of concerns. I mean, you actually had this week, within the past 72 hours, Pfizer and Moderna, their CFOs have stepped down.
Yes.
Within 1 week of each, you know, within.
Well, the way this was presented in the Wall Street Journal is that both companies needed new expertise CFOs because they had what they called a wind flow of cash, that they had so much money from the U.S. government. And in fact, there were reports just this morning that the U.S. government continues to buy up vaccines that are going to waste because they still have this requirement for extreme refrigeration. And there is not the same level of demand that we had at this time last year. So the United States government continues to stockpile and buy them up. So the stock prices seem to be doing just fine right now. But who knows if we're floating on a bubble here.
Thank you.
So interesting that we've got admission from Pfizer in the SEC that they might not even pass the regulatory trials. They might not get full approval. And if they do, they're worried about basically the public and doctors not using their product. So just like you heard them say right at the very end, the governments of the world are still buying up the product, but the people are not taking it. So now you've got this, their stock is basically falsely inflated because governments are still buying up vaccines that have an expiry date on them and nobody's taking them. So, and then I'd like to just point out that the MP that you heard questioning AstraZeneca's CEO was Garnet Genius from Fort Saskatchewan, Alberta. And he's always seems to be doing the right thing in any time that they get these panels. He's asking the right questions. So, but also a little compare and contrast with California. California is right on par with probably Quebec would be the best example. Quebec is the most, right now, the craziest Canadian province when it comes to like tyrannical lockdown measures and vaccine pushes. So Quebec and California are your top two. So that legislation that you're seeing in the open in California is probably getting backdoor pushed in provincially. I'd be willing to bet at least Quebec, but probably more provinces. BC would be right up there with California. That kind of stuff where doctors can be like convicted or lose their medical license for questioning the narrative, basically. It's kind of scary to see that type of stuff. That's full on fascism. That's why I call these people fascists. That's fascist behavior, to silence or any type of opponent to anything that they're trying to push through. That's there's no other way to describe it. Okay, my friends, what I want to do next is I want to divert your attention south of the line because we've got a new documentary that we're all anticipating. It's called 2,000 Mules. And on O'Bannon's War Room the other day, they had a guest that Catherine Engelbrecht, she's one of the people that led this basically study on this, I don't know, like this ballot harvesting operation that they ran. I believe they studied five states, and they've got in not so many words, they used cellular triangulation to monitor the behavior of people at these drop boxes, and they've got irrefutable proof that there was an operation in the five states that they studied of ballot harvesting. Like, and so it's very interesting. It's going to be a little bit long, but you got to hear it because this is in anticipation for some irrefutable evidence of the 2020 election fraud that we witnessed in the U.S. And this is the start of the turning of the tides, if you want my opinion. So up to this point, the world media has been able to just turn a blind eye. Now, we know they won't recover it. They won't report on it. They won't do anything. But what they did was because they took this evidence to politicians in each of these states, and they just did nothing. They actually actively tried to cover this up. They're releasing this documentary to get it out to the American people. Now that changes the scope, because then you've got people that are, you know, actively ignored and covered this up. Now they're in trouble. So let's turn it over to O'Bannon and Catherine Edelbrecht. And so you guys can hear exactly how they did this and where it's kind of headed.
Catherine Engelbrecht, a very unique individual. She's been at this for many, many years, and she's been warning people about the situation with voter integrity and all that. And she's been doing great work. First, I think it was the King Street Patriots, one of the first Tea Party groups, and then True the Vote. Catherine, you've got some disturbing video. It doesn't have sound to it, so we're going to watch some as you walk us through it. But I want to go back in the idea, given your understanding and deep understanding, the many years you've been doing this, of what happened on 3 November. I want you to walk people through how you conceived how we got to the receipts. How did you conceive it? And then you went and obviously got people to back you, and then you went and did it. So walk us through this whole thing of geofencing and all this is kind of complicated for folks. Walk through how you knew kind of immediately what had happened and how you got to the solution here.
Sure thing. Well, as you said, we've been doing this a long time. And so when we saw the changes that were coming in 2020, the lawfare that was happening to change the process in the under the cover of night, where people were not aware of standards and checks and balances that were being removed, what we began to formulate was, how can we prove up the abuse of this process? And so, you know, we all watched as hundreds of millions of dollars funded these private drop boxes that showed up all across at least the states that we were looking in, five states and five jurisdictions in those states. We thought, okay, if those are going to be abused, what data trails are going to be available to us to prove that up? And so we developed a plan to geofence around the drop boxes. As you see there on the screen, that drop box, we basically put a digital catchment that formed like an invisible fence, and then bought a massive amount, 10 trillion cell phone pings. So we left no oxygen from the cell phone by. And what that really means is, on your cell phone, all your apps that are on the phone, resident on the phone, or the ones you add, are all sending up signals telling those apps and the marketers that buy those signals, telling them where you are, the longitude, latitude, where you've been in the past, the elevation of the phone, the timestamp. So that data trail plus the invisible fence made for a calculus that allowed us to measure how many times a single device passed through the fence. And at that point, we began to sort of separate what was normal behavior and what was outlier. And that is the name of the movie, 2000 Mules, represents those outliers that we studied in great detail, their paths, their patterns, and is what we're, you know, now finally bringing to a big screen, and hopefully to many investigations across the country.
Okay, so whereas Rigged or those guys that we've had, you know, the Thomas More Society, everybody laid out the intellectual architecture of Zuckerberg and Zuckerbucks and everything like that. The difference here is that this really shows you it by both data and video exactly it happening. It is the hardcore receipts. That's why, you know, people have known about, you've been working on this for a while. That's why this is so explosive, correctly? Because they can't spin this, correct, Catherine?
Right. That's right. That's right. And the video piece was, I mean, we fought for this video for better part of a year in most places. And frankly, in a lot of jurisdictions, even though they were telling voters, oh, yes, we have surveillance video, they didn't. So we have, even though we have 5 million minutes of video, still, you know, a fraction of what should have been available. Nonetheless, our data, our geospatial data, could be threaded together with this video that helped us find these needles in the haystacks. And we have thousands of images like what you're seeing here. I mean, if you want to take a look at what this guy's doing, he deposited his ballots out of his backpack, and then he started to bike off in the dead of night, and he realized, doggone it, I messed up. I did not take a picture of myself doing that, and now I've got to go back, and you'll see it here in a second. He's looking around. He's already come back. He's already put the ballots in the box, and now he's got to take his picture.
He's got to take his picture to get paid, right? Got to show proof. He's proof to the guys paying him. When you say 2000, if you went through this massive data and did the mm-hmm. ring fencing of all the ballots, you came up with, when you say 2000 Mules, which is the name of the film, It's because you see 2,000 ballot harvesters in different locations throughout the country?
Correct. You have to think of it as, even though that number, it's, you know, the top line number is a big number, think about it as a series of micro insurgencies all across the country. We had 242 mules in the greater Atlanta area, 202 mules in the Maricopa, Yuma County area, 100 some in the Milwaukee County area, over 500 in Wayne County, which is Detroit, over 1,000 in Philadelphia County in Pennsylvania. And those are just the jurisdictions that we studied. Now, I want to stop here and just tell you about this one real quick, because this is something DC kind of missed it. It goes so quickly on these videos. This is a mule that if you watch what he did when he first walked up, he pulled his shirt sleeve down over his hand to put the ballots into the box. It's this kind of stuff that you have to watch. And I mean, the effort it took to mine through this video. And my partner, Greg Phillips, led a team of 12 analysts. Okay, watch, we back it up. Back it up. Watch how he. Okay, you're good there. Now move it forward. You see how she pulled her, or I don't know if it's he or she, frankly, pulled it down over her hand. It's that kind of little detail. Now, of course, we see people wearing surgical gloves. We see people taking pictures to get paid. It's as though there are, in these insurgencies, different directives given. And then there's slightly different directives given jurisdiction to jurisdiction, state to state. But then you have some commonality. For example, what happened in Arizona, there were indictments that were handed down to people that were ballot trafficking based, and the way they got them was based on fingerprints on the ballot. Well, the following day, the indictments were made public. Mid-December, the following day, we start to see in the Georgia video, people showing up wearing surgical gloves. So there is coordination, and this is a coordinated effort. And, you know, you said something in the previous segment, there are no more easy choices here. This is from here forward. You're seeing the subversion of process. You are seeing the theft of an election. The numbers are staggering. And now is the point where we have to say, what are we going to do about it? Because you can't look away.
Before I get to that, what we're going to do about it, this is what, because this cuts to the heart. Look, we're the dead enders. We're never giving up on 3 November because we say we can't, because you can't steal a presidential election, particularly in a time like this, or any time, but particularly in a time like this.
Right.
We owe it to the 13 or 14 generations that came before us. And we know it was stolen. We've seen the evidence.
Right.
Here, what you have done, and I think unique to everybody else has been at this, and there have been so many great people, you actually bring what we call the receipts. You have the data, which you can't lie about. It is what it is. And then you tie it back to a video at that specific point in time. What I think is confusing to people, and this kind of gets to a lot of stuff about the vaccines, et cetera. You just named some locations. You got Raffensperger. You have a Secretary of State, Republican Secretary of State in Georgia. You have Bill Barr that was at DOJ. You have authorities. This shouldn't have to be on Katherine Engelbrecht and True the Vote, a volunteer organization with a few staff, to go raise some money from people to go buy this data. This should be, and not even the RNC, right? We'll talk about this, but this should be secretaries of state. This should be election officials, many of whom in Arizona and in Georgia, to cite two, are Republicans. Why is the system not working? When if Katherine Engelbrecht can go by and do this, why couldn't they do this?
I think it's a function of what's really important to those in power, and it's staying in power. It's not looking back. It's not trying to unpack what really occurred. I mean, frankly, this surveillance video, there's no indication that any jurisdiction that we studied was actually looking at it, was actually monitoring it. Many of them, once we presented it to them, they didn't even know how to get into the video themselves. So what's the point? What's the point of having laws if we don't intend to enforce them? And I think that that's sort of the great statement around what happened in 2020. It was lawless. And at what point do we say no more? And that's, you know, that's the question we face now, because we saw an absolute subversion of process, because the fraud has been allowed to become institutionalized. And we have to wake up and say, it's not okay. I totally agree with you. We cannot move on from 2020 because there is no moving on thinking that 2022 is going to be any better. How? It's going to get worse. Criminal behavior only gets worse if you allow it to. And we are. We're allowing it unless we stop it based upon what we already know in 2020.
Go through some choppy ones, but listen, the power of this show is that it's the audience. It's the deplorables. It's MAGA. It's you guys use your agency and make things happen. That's why people fear this show as they should fear it, because you're not going to back down one inch. And Catherine Engelbrecht's not going to back down one inch. And the True the Vote folks are not going to back down one inch. She's called this and she's got the receipts. Having these receipts, ma'am, and you got a movie coming out. Dinesh, I heard, it's done a great job. It's fantastic. 2,000 Mules is going to premiere down at Mar-a-Lago. And we'll be all over that. But more than just the movie is the evidence in the facts yourself. We must get to the bottom of 3 November. We just have to. When it's a sore that's not going to heal. And that's what the left and the Republican establishment don't understand. We're never going to back down on this. And this is just not about President Trump. He's the first man. It's greater than President Trump. This is about the way this nation is run. And he's been very upfront about that. This is bigger than him, and that's why he's not backing down on it. It's not why we're never going to back down on it, ever. So, Catherine, a lot of these have been people in these offices that have been supported by this audience. People rang doorbells, and they gave money, and they got their friends to vote. I got Arizona, but I particularly got Georgia. Because Georgia, you got Kemp, who's Secretary of State for 8 years, and he's governor, and Stacey Abrams in this tightly contested thing. You got the consent decree. You got all this madness. You got Raffensperger. Now they got a grand jury down there against President Trump, and they've lost every other grand jury, but they got this one down in Georgia. Walk me through Georgia. Did you present this evidence, this brutal evidence of that? These are facts. These are not opinions. These are hard data, ring fencing off of cell phones and videos to go with it. Did you get a chance to present this to the authorities in Georgia, ma'am?
This was presented to Governor Kemp's team and the head of the GBI and his team in late April, early May of 2021. Now, we didn't have the video at that time because we were still fighting to get the video, but we had all of the geospatial data arranged. We had already isolated the mules. We had presented a number of other databases along with that to show a number of other nexus that were worth investigating. And they spent the next 7 months covering it up. It wasn't until President Trump
hold
came
it.
To
hold,
Georgia
hold, hold,
and
hang
held
on,
a rally.
Hang on, hang, hold it, hang on, sure. slow down. Because you're very precise with language, you've been doing a while. When you say cover up, you met with them in April of 2021, April and May of 2021, presented the geospatial evidence off the phones. When you say cover up, what do you mean by that?
In that time period, that 6 to 7 months when investigations could have and should have been advancing, they were bobbing and weaving and saying, and they being specifically the GBI, saying, well, we don't have jurisdiction and we can't do it. We had already given a complete data set to the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the Atlanta branch, because we were very concerned about the maintaining the provenance of the data. We knew that at some point that would be called into question. Is this even legitimate? So we gave it to the FBI. The FBI and the GBI COLO, they're in offices together. And we said, walk down the hall and look at the data. We'll come in. We'll talk with you with whatever level of depth you want. Nothing. 6, 7 months. That part of it was sort of cover up level one. And it gets much worse. So I'm glad to spend a few more minutes with you going, you know,
please,
straight down
please.
Into what all really happened.
Please, we want to get to the receipts here, ma'am.
Well, here's the thing, you know, the facts are the facts, and Governor Kemp, you read the news that's coming out of Georgia about people wanting to move on from the election discussions but his behavior is what is suspect. His leadership is the choices he has made and the choices that he has, the actions that he has taken against our organization are, in my opinion, indicative of far, far deeper flaws in character that should be considered in the running of a state. That said, it wasn't until the president came and President Trump came and held a rally in Georgia and name checked through the vote about doing the work that we were in Georgia, that we finally saw some movement out of the GBI. What did they do? Then that was on Saturday. That following Monday, we see a letter published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that was written by Dick Reynolds, the head of the GBI, and released to the media, just torching our data and saying that, you know, they don't really see anything in it, which is ridiculous. You look at what even he lists himself in the in his recitation of our unworthiness, and it's clear that there's something there to investigate. But he puts this out into the press, and then it becomes sort of a feeding festival around Kemp's cronies to silence us. We had Kemp's chief of staff calling our contractors and getting them fired, telling them that if they didn't stop working with us, they would be fired from other state contracts. We have others of Kemp's cohort going into Senate meetings and saying all manner of untrue things about us, about our associates, all to delegitimize the work. Finally, we make a sort of a wake up, but the only path we have left here is to go through the Secretary of State. And so we submit in November of 2021, we submit full complaints. And Steve, I'll be happy to share those with you. We list timestamps. Look at the video, because at this point now we have the video. Look at the video and you'll see the illegalities. You'll see the very things that you should be investigating. We lay it out on a silver platter. Nothing for six more months. And finally, we get subpoenas. Great. We're moving forward with the investigation. And look, I'm very happy about that. That's a great thing. I'm glad that they're moving it forward. But those subpoenas so minimize the work and the accuracy of the data and the video and go to some sort of tabloidy exploitive, like they want to talk just about the whistleblowers. And my belief is they want to try to discredit a whistleblower and then by association discredit the whole thing rather than look at the body of work that is there before them. So they're playing a really cheap game and we're not going to be a part of that. We're going to give them, as we have long said, everything they need to solve this case. We've been trying to give it to them for over a year. And very soon, we're going to make everything we have public, and then America can help remind them to do the job.
So there you have it, right from the horse's mouth. The evidence is there. There's been cover-ups by state-level governments to stop the investigation into the 2020 election theft. They've got irrefutable evidence. And they've been hitting roadblocks by, you know, they were using Georgia as the example, which is the governor is, I believe the governor is Kemp and the attorney general is Raffensperger, both of which are familiar names for those of us that have been following this story since it happened. But they were the ones putting up the roadblocks in Georgia, which was one of the major ones that... Where the election fraud was rampant, which honestly, if you want my opinion, it's probably in every single state. But they had to focus on the swing states that determine elections. So it's all there. Keep your eye out for the documentary when it comes. It's produced by Dinesh D'Souza, and I don't know the exact release date. I'll look into that right now. Actually, it premieres on May 7th. And that one is a theater screening. So what we'll have to do, my friends, is just keep an eye on Rumble, BitChute, all the off mainstream outlets, and someone will post it. And just make sure you watch it because this hasn't gone away. Just because the mainstream propaganda media isn't reporting it, now it's beyond proven. And just pretending it didn't happen isn't going to make it go away. And so it's exciting to see that they are going to turn all the evidence over to the American people, which will in turn hold their elected representatives responsible. Okay, my friends, We've run well over the hour, but of course, this information, I wanted to get it out to you. It's all really cool stuff, groundbreaking stuff that's worth sharing. So, as always, if you want to reach out to me, you can find me on Facebook. It's Canadian Patriot Radio. Use the message button. It comes directly to me. Now, I've recently kind of discovered, or I'm on to the fact that I think CPR is being shadow banned on Facebook. We had an amazing last month and a half of growth. We were getting a ton of followers. And I think it caught the attention of the Facebook gods or the algorithms. And now I'm having trouble accessing the page. Anytime I get notifications from the page, it takes me to Messenger, which is so stupid. So they're playing some dirty pool on Facebook, but we're still there. I've just got to go different routes to get to it, and I can't see the notifications anymore. So I think they're actively starting to suppress the CPR page on Facebook, but whatever. Until they actually ban me completely from their platform, I don't do really anything with the page that they can actively ban, other than just posting the podcast there and the occasional post about random topics. But so we'll see what they're actually trying to achieve there. If you prefer email, it's CanadianPatriotRadio@gmail.com. There is the Telegram room, which I have been a little bit distant from lately. I'm going to try and up my presence there. That is t.me/CPR_2. And if you prefer websites, it's CanadianPatriotRadio.ca. As always, my friends, if you like the show, give us a thumbs up and share us on any social media platform you see fit. It's only word of mouth that the show gets out. Intentionally, we're trying to keep it a little bit under the radar, which is kind of counterproductive for this. I realize that. But at the same time, the censorship is just overwhelming. This show has already been completely censored once by Spotify. So, you know, that's why I'm not in a huge panic or push to become big. Because we talk about the controversial stuff that they don't want us to talk about, like election fraud and the failing of Pfizer. Pfizer's plummet from grace, I guess, is the way to describe it. But it is what it is. We'll just keep doing what we do. And then we'll see what happens. If the Liberals censor the internet in Canada, well, then we'll go to a private network and we'll still be available. So that'll take some doing. I've been looking into it. I'm lucky. I happen to have a genius nephew that knows all about that stuff. So we'll go to a private network, and then from there, it'll just be a different like website that you'll have to search, and then the podcast will be available. So we'll see. Hopefully they can't get that through, but you just never know. This fascist liberal government is just marching ahead with their WEF agenda, and they don't give a rip what the Canadian people think. Okay, my friends, until next time, in all thy sons command.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Canadian Patriot Radio. CPR is not filmed before a live studio audience. If you like the show, friends, make sure you give us a thumbs up and share us on all your social media platforms. Until next time, take care.